Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Well,
here's John Williams.
I don't have to. The Trib did again. How do you like that? It's 107. This is John. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Thank you for tuning in.
Lord have mercy.
Lots of ground to cover again today, including a listen back to some of Justin Kaufman's show last night. I was driving around listening to Justin, as I often do, and heard some things that were pretty dang good. And I said, hey, Justin, come on with me today after 1:30. We'll listen to some music he featured and get his views on some of the news stories of the day. Justin isn't on tonight, and I've got a window of opportunity to talk to him. We'll follow the market through the close. It was this morning, as you know, down 500. I went to get a cup of coffee. It was up 300. It's been playing towards the middle of late. It's just cuckoo bananas. We'll follow that again with Bob Westrick, who is a partner at Private Vista. John Mahoney has passed away since we did this show last. We'll reflect on that a little bit as well. We asked Rick Pearson from the Chicago Tribune to come into our studio today, the noted political reporter and host here on WGN Radio. Hi, how are you?
It's good to be with you, John.
It's good to be with you. I thought you said it's going to be with you. And I thought, well, what's going to be with me? It's good to be with you, sir.
May the force be with you.
You were just out on the road on assignment, huh?
Well, lots of things going on today.
Were you at a J.B. Pritzker thing?
I was not at that. We have somebody there, but I have news from a reporter who's at the scene who said that the Democratic governor candidate has apologized for some of those remarks.
Well, let's back up for a second, because we all heard years ago some of the Blagojevich tapes. This was part of the process of indicting and convicting him. He goes away to jail, and the tapes were sensational about a decade ago. And then they've reappeared in commercials. And so there was that angle. But then the Tribune, I click online this morning, has new audio, again of J.B. Pritzker and Blagojevich, and once again, Blago always scheming or negotiating or just thinking out loud what are his options. Barack Obama is going to be the president. He's got a Senate seat to fill. And if anybody ever loved that sort of process of, okay, if I put you there, then that means this here. Ultimately, always wondering, what does it mean for Blago and what does it mean for his wife? I mean, at the end of the day, didn't you always get the feeling that was the end game for Mr. Blagojevich?
Well, sure. And frankly, that was in the tapes played in court, was very much about ways that he could set himself up for the future, realizing now with the election of Barack Obama that it had eclipsed his own star, because Blagojevich thought he was going to be president one day.
And other people did, too, if that sounds crazy. I'm telling you, there was a time when they thought, boy, this guy's ready. Good-looking, popular, friendly, big state, yada, yada, yada. You know, he was nuts, and I guess he was criminal as well. So here is the tape now. We have a few clips to play for you from what the Tribune. How did you guys get these? Was this a Freedom of Information request?
No. We really don't talk about the sourcing of our material.
This is FBI stuff?
These
are the wiretaps.
Yes.
Okay, so here again, it's sort of like the way people would get ensnared in a tape. No, the Russian investigation, right? You're listening. They weren't listening for J.B. Pritzker. They were listening for Blagojevich. Lo and behold, Blagojevich is talking to Pritzker. So now, a decade later, Pritzker has this embarrassing moment, even though nobody ever said at the time he was doing anything wrong. J.B. Pritzker wasn't on our radar then, right?
Right. And in fact, Pritzker is always quick to point out that he was not charged with any wrongdoing. But there's still the fundamental question of everybody knew that Rod Blagojevich was under federal investigation at that time. So why would you be having these conversations?
Okay, so we'll play these conversations here. But so is to you then the most damning thing not what he said about positioning an African-American to Blagojevich's advantage? Or is it the fact that JB is talking at all to Rod Blagojevich because he's toxic at this point?
Well, I think, one, the latter is the most valid question. But I think truly what we're trying to do here, and as part of this overall story on race and politics, particularly in the Democratic primary, this is kind of an example of kind of the dynamics that go into the sausage making of politics in Illinois that you don't normally get to hear because they're held behind closed doors.
So a decade later now, we hear then-Governor Blagojevich and a guy you didn't know that much about named J.B. Pritzker. Pritzker's been trying to get himself in Blagojevich's ear as a Treasury candidate,
right.
Illinois treasurer. But they're talking about all sorts of options. What are they going to do with Obama's vacated Senate seat?
You talked about the possibility of appointing Lisa to the Senate seat, but I don't know whether you were just speculating. I got a great idea for you, though.
Okay.
Jesse White. Even though I know you guys aren't, like, you know, bosom buddies or anything, it covers you on the African-American thing.
Correct.
He's Senate material in a way that Emil Jones isn't, if I may say.
Okay.
And it opens up the Secretary of State spot, which is the key spot.
Right.
You know, controls jobs, et cetera. And it'd be a lot less pressure on you. You don't have to put an African-American in that spot.
Correct.
So there you have an example of the dynamics here. And Jesse White, obviously the most popular African-American elected official in the state, five-term Secretary of State.
Well, what's the worst of what we just heard?
Well, I think one is the African-American thing, just as an acknowledgement. And I have to think that truly one of the best critiques of that was the issue of Letitia Wallace. She's a state representative from Rockford who's Daniel Biss's running mate in the Democratic governor race, where she said it's a conversation about treating people of color as commodities.
Here's another clip from that conversation. This goes a few seconds later and sort of furthers that ball down the road.
I know the Jesse White thing is like it's not a perfect thing because he's not like your best friend, but it does cover you and it doesn't get you Jesse Jackson Jr., which, oh, God, please.
Yeah, both of them laughed derisively at the notion of Jesse Jackson Jr., who at that moment was pleading with anybody that would listen for that job. He really wanted that job.
He even put out a poll showing that he was the most popular successor.
And was a good candidate, in my estimation, at that time.
Well, but then you also had the fact that businessmen affiliated with Jesse Jackson Jr. at that time were rounding up cash in a way to help Blagojevich.
We didn't know all of this at the time, did we?
Not at that time, no.
I mean, just I remember we talked to him at that time, and I said, well, do you want the job? He goes, yes, I do. And I said, well, have you expressed that to the governor? He said, I'm telling everybody. And we all kind of laughed. And, you know, Jesse Jr. seemed like a bright, young, viable guy for Illinois, for Rainbow Push or for Illinois, for that matter.
And then look what happened.
I know. I sound naive or dumb here, but you got to remember, I didn't know then what I know now. None of us did. Okay, here's another now clip from that same conversation 10 years ago this fall that J.B. Pritzker had with then-Governor Rod Blagojevich.
But if you're forced to put an African-American in the spot, which my guess is, you're not forced to do anything, but you know, my guess is a lot of pressure to do it. Of all the African-Americans I can think that are sort of like qualified and people and vetted and people will say, oh, that's a pretty good pick. The one that is least offensive and maybe gets you the most because it gets you that Secretary of State appointment is Jesse White.
You can argue he's, you know, he's got a lot in common with Obama. He's black and white. How stupid is that?
Here's the truth, though, also, right, Rick? If in a situation like this, the next Secretary of State or U.S. Senator or police superintendent or Chicago Public Schools CEO is not an African-American, you'll have some splaining to do. I mean, as much as there is the notion of decrying this commodification as people of color, so too is there an expectation that you put those people in those positions. So what's uglier, the conversation or the fact?
No, I think and certainly there's an expectation. And at this point, unlike the police superintendent or something else, you're talking about filling the vacancy of an African-American who was just elected to become the first black president of the United States. So the fact of filling that vacancy with an African-American would be, quite frankly, a political no-brainer for the Democrats.
Okay, but
the other. Well, but I mean.
But why? Why? Because all blacks are the same? No.
No, not at all. But a qualified African American, you're looking to fill, and quite frankly, at that time, I believe there might have been one other African American in the United States Senate, maybe two. So, I mean, it's more of a political statement, but it's also a representation from Illinois to the nation.
Okay, but I want you to acknowledge that I'm onto something here. This is an ugly conversation these guys are having.
This is the point of the story, is basically about race and these calculations that go in among all of these candidates.
And we don't always, and when it, without watching them make sausage, when the sausage comes out and we say, oh good, well you've got a black running mate, or oh good, we've put an African-American in a position of power, but not too much power in state government, everybody sees that as sort of coloring the political landscape appropriately. And where do you put them? And those decisions get made all the time, and we watch them happen before our very eyes, and we never question how they're made. And I don't know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? But then when you hear it happening, it's really ugly or icky, isn't it?
Sure. And well, and in this case, for example, if Jesse White, you hear Pritzker say, if Jesse White were to get the appointment, that opens up the Secretary of State's office. And that doesn't necessarily have to be a person of color. But it is one of the biggest jobs in Springfield as far as the number of jobs and patronage that it controls.
Oh, that's the job in Illinois, isn't it,
well,
Secretary of State?
It's a bigger office than the governor's office on the second floor of the State House.
And maybe a safer office, too. I don't know.
If you do the job right. Let's remember George Ryan's issues all stemmed from the
Secretary of State. But it's been the springboard. You could have that job, or you can use it to greater things if you want, if you do it right.
Alan Dixon became U.S. Senator from there.
And then they also threw Valerie Jarrett's name out and then dismissed that. She seems to me to be qualified, close to Obama's, African-American. But they sort of dismissed it in this conversation because they didn't see the value of it to Blago.
Well, Blago was looking for return. Looking for a return. And in fact, Valerie Jarrett's name was very much in the mix until all of a sudden her name got pulled. And I think there was the fact that everybody's getting wind that Blagojevich was trying to sell the seat.
Chicago Tribune and WGN Radio's Rick Pearson is in our studio. We're talking about this discovery that they're not saying how they got of some more audio between J.B. Pritzker and Blagojevich 10 years ago. They've posted the audio online. I mined some of it today and edited out the swear words from the governor. In this clip, you see Blago considering one more candidate for, I guess, for the Senate position that has just been vacated or is about to be vacated by Barack Obama.
God, if I knew for sure I wasn't running again.
Yeah.
How about Reverend Wright?
Oh, my God.
Still
there.
Yeah. No, how about sending Reverend Wright there? I bet you he'd take it.
Hilarious.
Huh? Would that be funny?
Hilarious.
Yeah. Right there on the Senate floor. It's not God bless America. Damn America.
Damn America.
When Barack was at Sunday school, I used to tell him.
Oh, and that went. Is that the worst of it?
I think that's a subjective call. I mean, I think the fact of that this is treated as a joke or whatever, I think could be very problematic.
It's so in private. I mean, again, I'm hearing the same stuff you are. It's sad. It's angering, but it's also private, and it's happening today. And it happens both ways. And I'm not exactly sure how fair all of this is to color JB's candidacy with a private conversation where the whole time in the back of his mind, he's not trying to say bad things about blacks. He's trying to become state treasurer. And Barack Obama and Rod Blagojevich is this loose cannon. And he's just playing him along to try and gain favor so JB can be the state treasurer.
All the time that this conversation is going on, everyone in the state of Illinois knows that this governor is under federal investigation.
So that was the big boneheaded part of this. He should have known that Blago was toxic at the time.
Everybody knew Rod Blagojevich was under federal investigation.
I'm listening to, fair enough, Rick. I think that's, maybe I've buried the lead here. You should have had the sense to or the ethics to stay away from Blago in this capacity, right? But as I'm listening to this and the other tapes, the full 12-minute conversation that Rauner released where you hear him go on at great length about trying to noodle his way in for treasure, I'm thinking of Billy Bush. I'm thinking of Billy Bush because, you know, Blago is saying stuff that I don't know what JB is thinking, but he probably doesn't endorse or love it, but he's not about to rebuff him because he's the governor and he wants something from him. In fact, just for a second, Elif, this is 10 seconds of Billy Bush and Donald Trump.
I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just, like, I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab. I can do anything.
Okay, so that ends Billy Bush's career.
I knew you weren't going to be able to play probably more than 10 seconds.
Isn't it a shame that two of the most famous things the president has said you can't play on the radio? So that ends Billy Bush's career. And maybe this compromises JB's aspirations. I'm still not sure. I mean, tell me what box to put this in. What perspective? What should I make of JB's candidacy for governor now, based on these old conversations with Rod Blagojevich?
I think it's fair to assess those conversations against what he has said and done as a philanthropist, as a billionaire, as efforts to do what he says is outreach to the African-American community that predates his run for governor. Things like early childhood education, all of those kinds of things. I think it's like everything else when you look at a candidate, it's a balancing act. And you have to take the good and the bad because there's never a perfect.
Rick, I want you to comment to us after a quick break on what Tammy Duckworth and Donald Trump have been saying about each other back and forth in a minute. So, Elif, we've agreed that we'll start with President Trump. This is what he said on a campaign stump speech about the reception he got. Campaign stump speech, I know, but he's doing these. About the reception he got from Democrats at the inaugural address.
Un-American.
At the State of the Union address, not his inauguration. That was another speech, but this is the State of the Union.
Un-American. Somebody said treasonous. I mean, yeah, I guess why not? You know, can we call that treason? Why not?
So they didn't clap. They sat there with a lot of hate in the room. It was bad energy. He said it was un-American. Somebody shouts out, that's treason. And then he whimsically, I think in Donald Trump's defense here, he wasn't calling it treasonous. That was a joke. I know words matter, but he didn't originate that notion. He said un-American, somebody said treason, and then you heard his attitude about that. Tammy Duckworth had already coined a phrase for the president and then used it again in a tweet. This is what she says about that.
I have a message for Cadet Bonespurs. If you cared about our military, you'd stop baiting Kim Jong-un into a war that could put 85,000 American troops and millions of innocent civilians in danger.
So she coined the phrase cadet bone spurs. And then again, after the president said it was un-American to not stand and applaud him, said, hey, cadet bone spurs, freedom of speech is a very American thing. Rick Pearson is in our studio. We're playing ping pong between the two of them here. How do you score this one?
Well, I do think words matter. And yes, the White House said, obviously, the president was joking when he mentioned the term treasonous. But nevertheless, words should matter. But with this president, they don't always matter. And that's part of the problem of this new dynamic, the new normal that we live in. I mean, politics, quite frankly, are how you're supposed to be able to judge politicians, judge those who govern us.
Yeah. Rick?
Well,
go ahead.
That's the way you're supposed to do it.
I know it.
And that's all flipped on its head.
Well, we're a year in, and that continues to be the challenge. What words of his to take seriously and which ones not, even when
And what's real and what isn't.
So I see the headline, Trump says Democrats who don't applaud our treasons are treasonous. And I think, holy cow. Now, he with a straight face said that's un-American. One feels like the other, un-American and treasonous. Those are different things. And I think treasonous is a more powerful,
important
word here.
That's a crime. It's enshrined in the Constitution.
Well, all right, but you don't think he actually meant that, do you?
I don't know that it necessarily helped to add that to it. I mean, un-American is more of a spiritual kind of concept of, you know, the whole issue of, as he's made very public, the standing for the national anthem, things like that. That's more of a patriotic feeling than it is a definition. Treason's a definition. And it's part of the hyperbole that he frequently uses, the part of the exaggeration that he frequently uses.
I talked to Jeannie Ives. I need 45 seconds from you on this yesterday. And then she has since said what she said to us yesterday. I'm not backing down from that really ugly ad that I've got running right now about J.B. Pritzker, about Governor Rauner. And the sort of representation of LGBTQs, blacks, the person who is there with the mask over his face and is thanking the governor for the sanctuary state status. And by the way, I said, that looks like an Irish kid, white skin, red hair. Why didn't you make that a person of color? She says, because that was the alt-left that they were depicting there. I said, wow, shame on me. I thought that the people that we're most benefiting from or that we should be most worried about in your eyes vis-a-vis this sanctuary state status would be people of color, immigrants. She goes, oh, no, that's not who we're picking on there. I said, wow, well, shame on me. I thought I got the color wrong. But she stands by the messaging still.
That is...
Are you surprised?
No. I mean, anybody who has covered Springfield and has seen her in the legislature for the three terms she's been down there from Wheaton, this is very much representative of her thoughts.
Who does she help more, herself, Rauner, or the Democrats with this campaign and campaign ad?
Well, I think most immediately she helps herself because it's getting all this attention, and her the biggest deficit she had was name recognition.
Okay,
now everybody knows who she is.
And what do they think of her?
Well, that's where it splits, and the question becomes, is she, as Rauner's people say, unelectable, or is she appealing to that same Trumpian base that exists in various parts of Illinois, and can that make up for the financial deficit she's going to be running against Rauner? She has gotten $2.5 million from a wealthy conservative donor who also was one of the biggest supporters of a Roy Moore super PAC in Alabama. I mean, there is an element of the Republican Party that has always been this way. And for the most part, they've been marginalized over the past two decades. Now they're very much part of the political landscape and fabric.
Rick Pearson's going to be on the radio next when's your weekend show?
On Sunday, 7 to 9 a.m. on the Sunday Spin.
It's before Dean Richards. It's a very good block, and he's a very good writer, and now he's got to go do some writing. Thanks, Rick. You hear Justin Kaufman later in the evening on WGN Radio. He's in our studio. When do you go on the radio normally?
Usually 7 o'clock, 7 to 11.
11.
Yeah. No show tonight because of the Blackhawks.
Hockey.
Yeah.
Baby!
It's like the promo.
Well, I hope you have a lot more missed shows, but I'm not sure how many more missed shows you're going to have this season,
right?
My friend.
Well, I still hold hope. Mark Carmen says, you know, he thinks they're going to take off and get to the playoffs.
The team has always had streaks, especially late in the season,
right.
But I think it's too late, and the streak we need is too long. I hope I'm wrong. I was listening to your show last night.
Yes.
I always do. I'm a big
fan. It was a good
one
last night.
Well, what I heard was good. That doesn't surprise anybody. I was listening to, what do you call the segment where you have artists come in and sing?
Studio 435. We do the best live music Chicago has to offer. That's what we do.
How often do you do that?
We do it every Monday night, 10 to 11. We do an hour. They play about four or five songs, and they play live. Bob Ferguson is the engineer who mixes it. Pete Zimmerman, the producer, is the guy who books it. But they're bands from Chicago, and they come in, and it's full on. It's not an acoustic. It's not scaled back.
And it's a hot mix, too. I mean, like, you know... There's no second takes. You guys have got to hit that first note,
exactly.
That first sound well. I guess they could fix it on the way, but you don't want to do that.
Well, what's great about it is when I'm in here in this studio, you can't tell because I can't hear the lyrics because
really?
You've got a drum kit. I mean, but when I'm in here, I love it because it's just so much energy. And the crowd will come on Michigan Avenue and watch through the window.
Yeah, but you don't know exactly
but
how,
I don't know
how
it sounds
on the radio.
No.
So I'm driving down the road going, oh, this is a high wire act. I know you do this, but I'm telling you, this is tough to do well. And this, so he introduces the band.
Last night was Beach Bunny, which is a Chicago band, all about 21 years old. And
playing
they're
at
indie
Shubas.
Rock. They're playing at Shubas tomorrow night. They are indie rock power pop. They are a young band from DePaul University.
They're still students. In fact, they said sometimes we get called to do gigs on the road on a Wednesday, and we say, no, we've got class. And I thought, right. What a great opportunity for them, getting a great education and yet so in demand that they have to decide schoolwork or band work. So the song that they first performed last night was called February.
Strawberry ice cream, a summer's day. You melt away through the cracks in my fingers. I know that sunburn goes away. The broken words I last heard still linger. Maybe by Monday I'll be okay. Any day's better than February. Sometimes I wonder how life would be. Any day's better than February. But if you called and you asked me to stay, would you give me the world or walk out in a day? Because I'm so afraid that if I let you in, when the going gets rough, will you leave me again like February?
They're not covering anybody there.
No.
That's their own
I
stuff.
I love
too.
Hearing that. I don't usually go back and listen to it. So what I heard was... I didn't necessarily hear that. I felt it because the drum kit is right behind my chair, full drum kit, and it just pierces you. And it's awesome, and I always wonder what it sounds like on air. So
but if the
awesome.
Drum was too loud, and normally you can adjust that after a while, but I mean, first note, first vocals was just spot on.
They're good. She's a really strong performer.
That's it. I was impressed with the mix, but I was also, obviously, this is for the band, I was impressed with the music. It sounds like the stuff my son Griffin is always listening to, saying, Dad, listen to this. And I always like it, but I never know who they are, and I don't go back and listen often enough. The name of that group is?
Beach Bunny. And they are all over social media, and they talked about that's how they get their gigs, and they are a band that beyond the flyer that you put on the dorm room bulletin board, they've moved all that stuff to social media. The great thing about Studio 435 is diversity. It'll Beach Bunny this week. Last week was the Lowdown Brass Band, which was an 8-piece brass. There was a sousaphone in here. But, I mean, you'll have that.
Do you have to tell security when we do
exactly.
that? Just so you know, we're
going
to bring in a sousaphone.
Diversity in age, diversity in background, diversity in genre. There's jazz, there's blues, there's rock and roll. There's a lot that goes into it, man.
So
it's
where are you going to be on a Monday night? Where will you be next Monday night or the Monday night after that or the Monday night after that from 10 to 11? That's what you're hearing on WGN 7 to 11. You're hearing Justin Kaufman. You're not hearing him tonight because of Blackhawks hockey. So let me just... play for you something that I presume you would have made time for were you on the air tonight. This is the president giving a campaign speech last night in Ohio.
No, it's bad energy. You're up there. You've got half the room going totally crazy, wild. They loved everything. They want to do something great for our country. And you have the other side, even on positive news, really positive news like that, they were like death. And un-American. Somebody said treasonous. I mean, yeah, I guess why not? You know. Can we call that treason? Why not?
Nobody said that. That's the beauty. I mean, there's a point in that clip where he says death. That's the end of the statement. He should have ended it right there because then you're like, yeah, I get it. They were being cold and they weren't giving him anything.
And by the way, Democrats did get a lot of bad, as much as the other party always gets ridiculed or criticized for not standing up enough or having those sad faces, Democrats got really beat up on Trump's speech.
I honestly think that that is an overblown tactic by the parties to not stand and clap. I mean, it's so ridiculous.
Right. If Nancy had done this, it would not have... ruined her reputation as a Democrat.
Right.
We know.
Exactly.
We know.
We get it. You're a Democrat.
But you're also an American, and he's the president. And I know he says terrible things about you, but I'd prefer that you be the adult in the room if he's not.
Yeah. Listening to him say that, though, the idea that you would go to un-American or treasonous when the party that you represent has done this, did the same thing. Just all you have to do is go back and look at the tape from 7 years of Barack Obama doing
Does
State
he not
of the Union.
Know that's how that game gets
I know,
played?
But he loves to stoke the flame. He loves the headline. I mean, this is a headline instead of Russia investigates Trump. I mean, this is an opportunity for him to
distraction. But the headlines become treason, and he's joking about treason
he's
and
joking,
repeating it about somebody else saying it. But he was stone-faced when he said that's un-American. And in fact, you could argue much more easily it's the essence of American.
Yeah, I just wonder, when he goes off script or wants to milk the audience for more, and he was speaking in front of a rally, right, or where he was last night at a conference. But the point being that he gets his point across, but then he didn't get enough. So he oomps, and he takes it a little bit further. So that's where he goes, it was un-American. Some say treasonous. Did I get your attention now? Is everyone paying attention?
Right,
and
it's right,
just,
right.
I don't think that he means that, but at the same time, he said it. He's the president. You have to recognize, being the leader of the free world, when you say a word, people hang on.
You're on tomorrow night. What are you doing?
A lot of music. Orbert Davis this week. We've got Dan Navarro from Lowen and Navarro, and Mike Reed, the founder of the Pitchfork Festival.
So, oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Do they have their next lineup set yet?
I don't think they do. He's doing something at the symphony with music, and this will be a separate project. But we'll sit down for an hour with him and talk to him about what he thinks about.
Well, when you put your show together, are you always thinking music, even on non-Monday nights?
No.
Are you always thinking, I've got to do Trump or politics every night? How do you?
I would like to do a little bit of news, but I also like to introduce people to Chicagoans that are making a difference and are being artistic. I feel like a lot of times musicians are easy because they express themselves. They put their music out and they're able to actually talk about the lives that they live and their experiences in their environments, and it makes for great radio to talk to musicians about their art because you can listen to the art. So it's always good to have musicians. I think I don't necessarily, it's not a music show, but when we get to the point of talking to interesting people about Chicago,
yeah.
I mean, that's the tagline of the show. It's a show about Chicago starring those who know it well.
Justin Kaufman. Okay, we'll miss you tonight. We'll listen to you tomorrow night.
Thanks, King John.
Yeah, nice to hear you, and what a good show last night. The name of that band again is...
Beach Bunny.
By the way, I get a 20 cents on every CD they sell. I don't know if you know that.
No CDs. They're just online. But
I know, God. For every album they sell, the 45s or the 33s.
Right. Every play, every click.
Oh, man. And there's people out there who don't know what a 33 and a 45
you get 0.001 cent for every click.
The man is so old. When I get to be king someday, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be the guy that's in charge of when the markets close. Got up this morning, clicked on, market plummeted, dropped 500 points. I'm like, oh, crap. I knew it was going to be more of this. I went to get some coffee and do what you do. Came back, it was up 300. I'm not making that up. Then it was up, down, about 70 points. Right now, the Dow is up 156 points. I would close her now and just go home. We'll talk to Bob Westrick again, who was on with us yesterday as the yo-yo market was making everybody crazy, and it was mostly yo-yoing down yesterday. We'll visit with Bob again in just a couple of seconds. He is a partner with Private Vista. Also in our studio right now, here's a company that you've heard of before. It's Grandview Homes. Grandview buys homes. You've heard that phrase before, and you may recognize the voice of Tom Detlitz. Hey, Tom, this is John. How are you?
Good, John. Thanks.
I guess I didn't need to say this is John. You're sitting right there. So I've heard the commercials. I've heard Lou Manfredini talk about Grandview Homes. You guys buy homes from people. Why wouldn't I use a realtor? How are you different than a realtor?
Well, if you've ever sold a home, you know it's a difficult and stressful process. It takes, well, first of all, you have to clean the home, fix the repairs, updates, even before you list it. Then you've got months of people coming through your home, strangers day and night, and then you get a contract and you hope they get qualified, and then they have an inspection. I mean, that's just a hard process. So we offer a different way. It's just easy. It's fast. We make a cash offer. You accept it, or if you don't, put it in your pocket, save it for later. Close in as little as 10 days.
So you're the buyer. So
we're a buyer.
You know, it's funny. I asked somebody, well, where's the commission? How much is your commission? You don't take a commission. You are buying the house. There is literally no agent in between you and the seller?
That's right. So the seller saves all that commission. And we take all the risk, basically. So we make a small margin on the sale. That is, we take it out of our offer price, a small profit for us.
Okay.
And the buyer gets basically a closing on the day they want to move.
So in theory, if I think I could sell my house for $100, but I'm only going to get $94 because I got to pay 6% commission, you're going to offer me about $94.
No, because you also have the repairs, the time you're going to have, the things you have to do to fix the house up, which we'll do. We'll take that cost on ourselves. So it doesn't sell for $100 until you fix it up.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right.
But after you net it out, net, so through a realtor or through Grandview Homes, it's about 4% difference.
Huh. But it's a lot easier because you write a check?
We write a check, right. And the amount that we offer you is the amount of the check. Nothing's deducted from it.
Who's your typical customer?
So it'd be anyone who needs or wants to sell their home fast and easy, but typically there are people who have homes that they've been in for, say, 10 or 15 years that need updates and improvements. It might be a family who they've lost their mom or dad, and the family has to sell the home, and they don't know what to do or how to fix it up. Or it could be somebody who just needs to sell it fast now.
Sometimes I pull off the interstate, and I see signs in the median that say, we buy homes for cash. Is that you?
Yeah, not really. So we are a professional company. We have 25 employees. We are the buyer of the house. The people who have those little signs, they're kind of wholesalers. They put your home under contract, and then they try to sell it to an investor. It's really not a good thing. We are accredited by the Better Business Bureau. We've been in business for 10 years.
What's the name of the company?
Grandview Homes.
What's the website?
GrandviewHomes.com.
Oh, how convenient. GrandviewHomes.com throughout Chicagoland, right?
Throughout Chicagoland.
Yeah. Keep up the good work. GrandviewHomes.com throughout Chicagoland.
That's right.
All right. Tom Detlitz, thanks for coming in. Nice to see you.
Thanks, John. Good seeing you.
Bob Westrick's a friend of ours. He joined us yesterday. He's back on the phone again. Hi, Bob. How are you?
Doing well, John. How you doing?
Pretty good. Bob is a partner at Private Vista. He's a money manager who has been answering questions about markets for us for years. By the way, is money manager the right way to describe you, Bob? I know some of those words mean things and some of them don't.
Well, that's a portion of what we do. We're wealth managers. We do a lot of planning for our clients also.
Take me through your day. I know you never get as upset or animated as I do, or maybe other people do, maybe because it's your business, although I think you would even be more like, holy cow! But when you got up this morning and you click on your computer after 8:30 and you see the market is down 500 points, what were you thinking?
Well, I mean, it was a little disappointing. Obviously, I didn't want to see that, John. But we don't take trader mentality. I mean, we're investor mentality. And, you know, just the fact that, like I said yesterday, you know, year to date, you're down 1 or 2% after, you know, huge gains last year and big gains the years before. It's not really that negatively affecting most of our clients' plans. So we really look at, you know, portfolios as just a mean to fund, you know, clients' hopes and dreams and retirements and stuff like that. And if it's not having that big of a negative effect, we don't get all that upset about the market, what the market's doing on any given day.
Yeah, well, but I am thinking bigger picture for other people or even your clients. Nobody wants to see that big of a drop, even though I know it wasn't in the top 20 drops of all time the day before or Friday, as a percentage anyway. It was still a lot. Nobody likes to see that. And then it was up 300. It had like an 800-point swing inside the same day. Right now it's up about 120-something. Do you think we've stemmed the tide on whatever's happening, Bob, if we close up, say, 100 points or so today?
Not yet. Right now we're up about 280, actually.
Are you kidding me? Because moments ago it was 127. It's up 280 now? Let me click on.
And it might be down 280 by the end of the day. I mean, to your point,
by the end of this click,
today have been enormous.
Yeah.
You know, and we've had very, very little volatility in the markets, you know, for years now. And now we're just seeing volatility that was actually very common, you know, just a few years ago. But nobody's really used to it. So that's why it's kind of so surprising.
Yeah, it's up 287 now. It's up 287. I don't even want it to close up 287. I mean, I don't want it to go any further up or down than it is now. I don't want to close up 500. I want it to just sit and chill, Bob. I don't want it to do this anymore.
You know, John, we talk a lot. I mean, I think it makes for good radio talking about the markets and stuff like that. But I mean, really, if you want to talk about stuff that can help your clients, I mean, really, what you should talk about is don't be a market watcher. You know, that's not really healthy.
Yeah,
it fuels a trader mentality and not an investor mentality.
Yeah.
You know, because humans being humans, what do we do, John? We want to buy after the market's gone way up,
mm-hmm.
and we want to sell when the market goes way down. And that's not a good long-term strategy for anything. Mm. People want to time the markets, but empirical studies have shown it's almost impossible to time the markets.
I know that.
So what you want to do to accumulate wealth over time, you establish an asset allocation, you know, of stocks versus bonds. You fund it with good managers. You rebalance over time. That's the way you accumulate wealth. And then you don't have to get real upset when the markets do these things.
Well, I understand that, but it would still be easier for my digestion if it wouldn't do this. I'll tell you what, Bob, it's almost 2 o'clock. Let me call you a little before 3 and let's see how we close the day, okay?
Sounds great.
That's Bob Westrick. He's a partner at Private Vista. Their website is myprivatevista.com.
thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Actually,
here's John Williams.
I'm going to try and clarify something here to start this hour. It's 2:09. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Hi, it's John Williams.
Lord have mercy.
I'm WGN King John on Facebook, WGN King John on Instagram, WGN King John on Twitter. Unfortunately, Violetta Podramedic does traffic with us, and now she's totally freaked out by Kim's news because of something she heard. It was during the story about how French fries cure baldness from McDonald's.
Were those little rats in the background?
No, it was definitely fryer oil, because the story starts out and says somewhere in that vat of fryer oil. So it's fries sizzling, no worries.
But we hear this...
I thought it was little mice.
And that was like Ben from that Michael Jackson movie, the rats all coming to get you. That sound that you hear sometimes under the floorboards? Or
No, don't take me there.
And you've been told, that's where you were. I'm trying to make that go away now. That was the fries frying, or it was the rats frying in the oil of a McDonald's fryer.
No, that's
no
not
matter
right.
what, John, you don't need the fries. You're in good shape.
Yeah, you're talking about a full head of hair.
My hair? Yeah, it ain't what it used to be, but I still got some. All right, fair enough. So, Violette, I hope that helps you and your anxiety.
Okay, well, I'll still go have some McDonald's French fries then.
Hey, by the way, how are we doing on our quest? I don't know that I've mentioned this in a while, but remember, there's that app that Google has where you can take your picture, upload it, and then they've got this algorithm that will automatically, it's an app, and it will automatically, in their arts and culture app, match your face to a work of art. The problem is it's not allowed in Illinois. The app knows where you are. Hey, you're in the confines of the state of Illinois. And literally, that button on the app won't appear. You go to Indiana, and magically it does. Who knew? So we asked Violetta and Elif to do it manually. You upload to my Facebook page your picture, just post your pic, and then Violetta and Elif are getting together and finding and editing that and putting you side by side. It's fantastic. It's fun, it's funny, and it's amazing what you guys are doing. We're going to cut it off at 100. Last I mentioned this, we were at about 85 or so. So we'll still do you. We'd love to see what you look like. You look great, and Violetta's finding really nice pictures, and Elif is making it look fantastic. So WGN King John on Facebook, post it there, and we'll see how you do. It's 2:12. So you were watching the Super Bowl the other day, Sunday, of course. I didn't mention this yesterday because the world was going to hell in a handbasket. The market was free-falling. But I wanted to play one of the commercials that nobody has been talking about that kind of touched me. It was a commercial for Stella Artois and water.org. Matt Damon is talking to you, and he's asking you to buy a chalice, a glass, with the Stella Artois insignia on it. And when you do that, money will help thirsty people in places like Africa.
Such a simple thing. Clean water at the turn of a tap. It's like magic. And yet millions of people in the developing world walk up to 6 hours every day for water. This chalice can change that. If just 1% of you watching this buys one, we could give clean water to 1 million people for 5 years. Join Stella Artois and water.org.
That's pretty amazing, isn't it? If 1% of you watching this, that is of the massive Super Bowl audience, if 1% of the people watching TV Sunday will buy that chalice, then they can give fresh water to 1 million people for 5 years. And I'm thinking, what? What's the chalice cost? $1,000? The chalice, the glass, is about, I think, $13. We reached out to water.org and asked them, how severe is the problem and how true is this claim? Melanie, are you there? You're on WGN Radio. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm here. Thank you for having me.
Is it Mendris? Is that how you pronounce your last name?
Mendris.
Mendris, Director of Brand and Marketing at water.org. That's the company that they're working for on that ad. What's water.org?
Water.org is an international nonprofit organization that uses access to affordable financing to get people access to water and sanitation who are in need of it. Hmm. And today there are about 844 million people who lack access to safe water. So we're working together with Stella Artois to change that.
840 million people without access to fresh, clean water.
Correct.
Get your head around that if you can. You're based in Kansas City, did I see?
You are correct. We are headquartered here in Kansas City.
Huh. I'm sorry, I've not heard of you guys. How long have you been in existence?
We have been in existence a very long time. Gary White, one of our co-founders, founded the organization more than 25 years ago. And then in 2009, he joined forces with Matt Damon, renamed the organization water.org. So we have been in existence for a long time. Our expertise in helping to solve the water crisis runs deep.
So when I, and is the claim in the ad true? Did I describe it correctly? If I buy this glass with Stella Artois' name on it, that they'll give part of the proceeds and that the simple purchase is that significant?
That is a correct claim. Right now, if someone purchases a Stella Artois chalice, Stella Artois does in fact donate $3.13 to water.org.
And if a if 1% of the people watching the Super Bowl ended up donating $3.13 to your organization, that would be the sort of funds that would for your organization get 5 years worth of water to 1 million people. It makes you think, well, hell, don't buy the chalice. Give them $6 and they can double their pleasure. But it's it's a commercial for Stella Artois. At the end of the day, Stella Artois is trying to sell beer. And this is kind of a funny conversation to have and not the point of the phone call. But if they want to sort of leverage your charity for the purchase of selling their beer, I'm okay with that. Right? I mean, I don't suppose you have a problem with that, do you, Melanie?
Well, we are okay with that as well. And also, to your point, this is a great opportunity to raise awareness for what we do. And so if someone opts not to buy a chalice or one of the special packs that also Stella Artois donates proceeds to us, someone can certainly donate. We will gladly accept that as well.
water.org, right? I mean, I guess there's a
exactly.
link there. Okay,
yep.
but you know, or buy the chalice and everybody wins, I guess, in that situation. I don't really care how you do it, just donate to this organization. And then do you like help people dig wells, or do you get them containers to capture rainwater? What's the means by which these people will get water for a year or five?
Well, if I could back up and tell you a little bit about our model, and then I can also answer that question about the kinds of water solutions that people take out. So water.org uses the money that is donated from Stella Artois or someone like you and me who cares to donate directly, essentially to fuel our work to get people around the world access to water. And we do that by getting them access to small, affordable loans. So what water.org does is we basically work with local financial institutions, and we help them establish water and sanitation loans in their portfolio of offerings. And the financial institution then sources capital through their local markets, makes the loan to someone in need of water or a toilet, and then that individual ultimately pays that loan back, gets the solution, and then that money goes back to the financial institution re-loan, which essentially creates a cycle that helps far more people than we could ever help directly.
So people are borrowing from banks to get whatever they need. It may be a faucet, it may be plumbing, it may be something to capture rainwater, right?
Correct. And so that's the other part of your question is it is important to understand that the water crisis is not universal. People who are experiencing this, the solutions they take out can range from geography to geography. So, for example, in some cases, a household is able to connect to a local water supply, right, through some kind of a connection in their home, a piped connection, a faucet, et cetera. In other cases, where households may be hours away from a water source, people would take out a loan for improvements such as a borehole well or a rain catchment system, which is what you mentioned.
You know, that old saying, better that you, rather than give somebody a glass of water, teach them how to build a well. But I guess that's not always the solution in other parts of the world because wells become contaminated. They don't have the means to keep the water clean or fresh, et cetera, right?
Correct. And in this case, by leveraging access to financing, we essentially have put in a system that we call sort of a pay-it-forward system, right? So we can help this institution create a portfolio of offerings in their business, and that stays. They continue to lend and make loans long after, you know, long after we do. So in that way, your donation almost goes further because we helped set up this microfinance institution to continue to make loans to people ongoing. We call it a multiplier effect.
So this isn't a charity that's giving bottles of water to poor people. It's an organization that establishes a means by which people in the developing world can borrow money, microloans to them, for the purpose of getting fresh water and sanitation. What a niche, but I guess a lot of big banks aren't interested in doing that. You've sort of set that up. The average, as I understand it, the average loan then that one of these people in the developing world takes out is about $300. 99% of those loans are paid back. The people are good for it. They want this, and they do pay it back. Once they get that superior means of getting water, tapping into a city line, a cleaner well, whatever. Once they do that, they pay the loans back, and I guess that's the end of that point. There was something else I was going to say there, but that's the model that you represent, right?
That is correct. That is exactly the model we represent, and it's working. So about 5 years ago, we were celebrating, changing a million lives with access to safe water. And just in the last month or so, we are now celebrating reaching 10 million people with access to safe water and sanitation. So this solution, this way of getting people access to affordable financing, essentially to solve their own water crisis in a way that works best for them, is scaling. It's gaining momentum. We know that we can reach more people faster. And I think that's what is in part makes it so exciting to be on a stage like the Super Bowl to give us an opportunity to tell people about how great this is working and why it's so important that we that you consider donating.
You know, and it's easy to imagine going, oh, I know what we'll do. We'll get a bunch of bottles of water and we'll send it to Africa. Or we'll get some wells and we'll dig wells for them and then they'll have water and all the problems are solved. And it's never so simple. It's not plug and play. Better that in each individual instance, almost household by household, people figure out what they need, or community by community, and then let's get them just the smallest of loans they need so that they can get water and pay it back. The cost for the organization is about $12. Most people are borrowing the money where it was not previously going to be available. Give me an example, just one, and then I'll let you go, Melanie. But give me an example of how somebody benefited from this scheme that we've talked about.
Well, this is my favorite part, is telling a story of a family that's been impacted. So here's an example, a woman named Lenarisa from Manila. She recently took out a loan and connected to the local water utility through one of our partners. She is now paying $4.50 a month for her water. And before she took out this loan, she paid a water vendor $60 a month to deliver water to her home. So now her loan payments are less than $5 a month, and it will take her less than a year to repay that specific loan, which means that's a significant difference in her monthly income, and it frees up that difference between $5 and $60 she was paying for other things to support her family, for better health, all of the things that come when someone gets access to safe water.
All the things we take for granted here, fresh, clean water, water.org. Water.org is the organization. Videos, more stories, and a simple way to donate there, or go buy that chalice. Can I buy the Stella Artois glass that Matt Damon was talking about on your website, or is that some other way?
No, you can. You can go to water.org/Stella Artois, and that will connect you to a place that you can certainly buy the chalices.
Well, good luck to you all. If we can help down the road, let us know, Melanie.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And I was listening to Ro Khan's show yesterday, and the news came that John Mahoney had passed away, and one of the first people I thought about was our Nick DiGilio. Everybody's got a story and a way to react to it. Bob Saget was talking about it yesterday afternoon with Ro. It was an interesting conversation. But I thought about Nick, and I don't know much about John Mahoney. I know a little bit about this guy named Nick DiGilio, who does a great show here, but It seems to me like I remember that Nick was pretty close to and a big fan of John Mahoney's. And Mahoney was really good about taking Nick's calls and coming on Nick's show. And so we, I don't know, did we wake Nick up? Hi, Nick. How are you this afternoon?
Hey. Yeah, normally I'm asleep at this time, but for some reason I was awake when I got the message that you wanted to chat about Mahoney.
Yeah. So what was your relationship like with him, Nick?
It was mostly through theater. I only like personally met him a few times, but when he would guest on Roy's show, I would always interview him. He was on my show, I believe, once or twice. And but I knew him through my connection to Chicago theater. One of the great things about John Mahoney was that, you know, he was this massive TV star on this big hit series. He made movies, but he always lived here. He lived in Oak Park. He shopped at a Jewel. You know, I mean, this is the kind of guy that John was.
Yeah.
And so his connection to Chicago theater, he did a lot of theater. I mean, everybody knows famously that he was a member of Steppenwolf. He did a lot of work with Steppenwolf, but he did work with non-union theaters, very small theater companies. And I knew him through that. I had friends who had acted with him, and I passed him through the circles of Chicago storefront theater. Always been a fan, obviously. But the one story that I think is my favorite John Mahoney story, after, you know, talking to him, you know, a few times and knowing him, you know, professionally through the radio station. This is years ago when I was still a drinking man. I was at a bar called O'Rourke's. And O'Rourke's was located at one point on Halsted Street, right across the street from the Steppenwolf Theater. And one night I was in there with a group of friends, and I had had a couple of cocktails. And Mahoney came in after a performance. He was in a play across the street at the Steppenwolf. He comes in, he sits down with a group of people at the end of the bar, and I'm feeling no pain. And I say to my friends, I'm going to go over to Mahoney. And, you know, he knew me. At that point, he knew me a little bit, not that much. You know, knew me from, you know, probably interviewing on the radio and stuff, but he wouldn't know me from Adam if I just came up to him without introducing myself. So I walk to the end of the bar, and he's there, he's talking, and I walk up to him, and I stick my hand out, he shakes my hand, and I scream in his face, I'm incarcerated, Lloyd! And that's my favorite line from Say Anything, which he says in the movie. So it's my favorite line, I'm incarcerated, Lloyd! And he starts laughing, gratefully, not punching me or having me removed from the premises.
No.
So I say the line, I smile, and I'm a big fan, and I walk away, and he sends a beer down my way. And then years later, Entertainment Weekly did an anniversary issue where they talked with people from movies that were celebrating an anniversary. So they were doing an anniversary piece on Say Anything, which I still think is Mahoney's best performance, movie-wise. And so they were talking with the cast and crew. They had John Cusack and Cameron Crowe and Ione Skye. And then they talked to Mahoney, and they asked Mahoney, what do you think about the longevity of this movie and the quotability of this movie? And he says, you know, I got to tell you one of my favorite stories. I was in a bar in Chicago, and this drunk guy walked up to me and screamed, I'm incarcerated, Lloyd, in my face. And it's one of my favorite memories associated with Say Anything. And that drunk guy was me. And so it's one of my favorite stories, and it's a weird connection that I'll always have. And the fact that, you know, like, he still remembered that and thought it was funny and not just some obnoxious idiot screaming a line of dialogue in his face. But that's the kind of guy that John Mahoney was. Kind to a fault and generous and just great, and obviously a great actor. I mean, just, you go back and see anything that he does. I mean, Say Anything is still my favorite performance of his, but he's great in Barton Fink. He's great in Moonstruck. He's great in Primal Fear. And obviously his work on Frasier, you know, goes without saying. He was a gentleman. And again, lived in Oak Park. You know, they offered him tons of money to do reunions for Frasier. He said, nope, I've made enough money. I can do theater and live in Oak Park, and that's what I'm going to do. So,
I love that story, Nick. Well, what was it about his craft? Michael Phillips wrote about that today. Probably film critics like you are thinking, talking, and writing about that all across the country today. But what was it that made him so good? What was it that made him John Mahoney?
I think it was you can identify with this guy. He was like an everyman, and it didn't matter what role there was. He brought a humanism to it. Like, he was just a guy that you immediately liked him, or if he played a villain, you found yourself, you know, attracted to him and mesmerized by him because he had that way about him. He was approachable, even in films. He was, and he had this quality. He was a hard worker, man. I mean, he was a guy who, you know, when he didn't start acting until he was 40. And you know, he was doing day jobs until then, and then he became a member of Steppenwolf. John Malkovich brought him in, and Steppenwolf was in its infancy at that time. And, you know, they were working out of a church at that time, doing shows out of a church. This was in the late 70s, and they just started their footing, and Malkovich brought him in because he thought, oh, this guy's a good actor, and also, he's old, he can play the older roles that we can't afford to pay older actors who are union. So they basically brought him in so he could play the older roles, and he took off from there, and his work ethic was beyond. I had a friend who worked with him in Long Day's Journey Into Night at a small Irish theater company. This was back in 2000, and said that his work ethic was amazing, and that that he was very generous, and he made other actors better. And you can see that in every movie he does. There's just this wonderful chemistry between Ione Skye, who plays his daughter in Say Anything. That relationship that they have is just it's subtle, it's complex. And both actors are at the top of their game. And Mahoney made people better, and he was just an incredible actor.
I think a lot of people are thinking of Frasier stuff. I hadn't thought about Moonstruck in a really long time, although I've always liked that movie. I don't know where that is on your list, but
I love it.
I remember that movie affectionately. And he has a small role in there, and so I went back and watched his scene in that movie today, and what an ass he was, you know. At one moment, and then utterly charming in the same scene. And I thought,
yeah,
how could you hate a guy so much, just go, oh, God, this guy's the worst. And then he sits down with Olivia Dukakis, right? And they have this lovely little dinner, and you go, oh, my God, this guy is charming. It was the same scene.
He does that similarly in a movie called Tin Men, which is a Barry Levinson movie about aluminum siding salesman with Danny DeVito and Richard Dreyfuss. And he's in that as well, and plays it similarly. Charming. You think he's obnoxious, but he's charming. And he was always like, he had a million-dollar smile too, Mahoney. Every time he smiled, he lit up a room. And one of my friends on Facebook posted my favorite picture, because everybody posted stories and tributes and stuff yesterday on social media. People were talking about it, obviously. But one of my friends on Facebook, who is a terrific writer as well, an author of great books, he posted. It was just the word goodbye, and then underneath it was a picture of the empty chair that Marty Crane sat in, that Frasier wanted to get rid of, and it was just a picture of that empty chair, and it said goodbye. And I thought that was like a really beautiful little tribute to John Mahoney.
Okay, bud, the Giglio Film Club is still up and running well?
Yeah. First Tuesday of each month. Tonight I'm hosting a big one. Tonight is one of the best movies ever made, The Philadelphia Story. With three little stars, you know, Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn, and Jimmy Stewart. Just a few stars are in it.
Why'd you pick this one, Nick?
I know. I can't figure it out. How can anybody pick this movie? Now, it's really seriously one of the best romantic comedies ever made. And to see it on the big screen is going to be a treat because, you know, I've never seen it on the big screen. The movie came out 78 years ago. So, and it still holds up. It's such a great movie. And it's also, I just wanted to mention, I'll be there. What happens is at these screenings, I introduce the movie. We watch it together, and then we do Q&A afterwards, and I give you behind-the-scenes stories and trivia about the making of the movie. And tonight we got a special treat. My late-night cohort, Patty Vasquez from WGN, is going to co-introduce the movie with me because it's one of her favorite movies of all time, and she knows every line. So I was like, well, come on down and introduce the movie with me. So the two of us are going to introduce it. We'll watch the movie. It starts at 8 o'clock. The movie starts at 8. And you can reserve your seats now at amctheaters.com. And it's at the Rosemont, 18 Rosemont, formerly Movie Co. So.
By the way, my producer on Saturdays, Griffin, has struck out this year to try and watch a movie a day for 365 days. And that sounds ambitious and crazy. And
he struck out. It's only February.
No, by that I mean he's struck out. He's trying to do that. He's, you know, cast off. He's trying to do that.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. I'm sorry. Okay.
So struck out, hey, it's only February. Couldn't get through 31 days plus a few.
I was going to say.
But then I thought, well, wait a minute. I'm like, this is crazy. Nobody can do it. And then I thought, no, I think Nick already does that. So how many movies do you watch a week, Nick?
Well, it depends on how many movies are released. There is an average, and then sometimes it's lower, sometimes it's higher, but there's an average of 5 movies a week if you figure it all out. And I see at least 4 or 5 a week, at least.
Yeah.
His
project is all of the movies are new to him. But for instance, if he hasn't seen Philadelphia Story yet, he'd go to your thing and watch it for the first time. Right about that, along with the other 6 he saw that week. So some of them will be The Shape of Water. some of them will be an old Jimmy Stewart movie all in the same week. So that's
that's fun.
That's the plan. All right, so let me just read this thing one more time, make sure everybody's got it. At the AMC Dine-In, Rosemont 18 in Rosemont, Illinois, join Nick DiGilio for the romantic comedy classic, The Philadelphia Story. Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn, James Stewart, digitally restored. The Nick DiGilio Fan Club at AMC, formerly Movico, Rosemont 18. Dinner, drinks at Bogart's at 6:30. The movie starts at 8, and then Nick leads a discussion afterwards. Patty's going to be there, too. $14.49, is that the cost for this bad boy?
Yeah, and it's free parking and free popcorn. And, you know, a bag of popcorn nowadays costs $17.50. So.
Hey, do you have the movie pass?
I do not. I do not. You know, I hear good things about it. I have friends who are using it. I go to the movies, I go to the movies frequently, but I use I have the AMC Stubs program, which I really like. You get rewards from that and everything. I know it's a different thing than the movie pass. It's a different kind of thing, but I'm happy with that. And I didn't change, but you get rewards, you get discounts, you get free tickets and all kinds of stuff. So I've been with the Stubs program for many years now, and I like that.
AMCtheaters.com. You on the radio tonight?
Right. Well, 2 a.m., yes. So actually technically Wednesday morning. But, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. And Patty precedes me, and we're both going to be at Rosemont tonight.
We'll be listening. Thanks, bud.
Thanks, buddy. I appreciate it.
That's Nick DiGilio. You hear him late nights, overnights on WGN Radio. I talked to Bob Westrick from PrivateVista.com a little while ago. Private Vista is the company. MyPrivateVista.com is the website. But he's that wealth manager that watches markets, money, and the economy for us. And the start of the market this morning, when the markets opened up, when the Dow opened up, it fell 500 more points right away. Were you anywhere near a browser this morning? Were you looking at that? You're going, oh, man, here we go again. I don't know when this thing's going to end. And I know just because the market's falling doesn't mean the economy's bad. And even if your portfolio is taking a hit, you've got some sort of 401k you've been saving on and now it's going down. That's a paper loss. I know. Nobody likes to see this happen. And maybe it's happening for the right reasons, like maybe the market was overpriced, or maybe it's a function of what happens when you get higher wages and when you get more jobs and inflation starts to creep into the market. That's not all bad for interest rates. My dad said to me today, hey, it looks like the CDs are going to go up. That's good for me. So it's kind of a complicated thing, and it's not 100% bad and not 100% bad for this time, right? Like maybe it's happening for some good reasons. Sean Hannity blamed it on Barack Obama, by the way, but I'm just saying it's more complicated than down is absolutely 100% bad. And in fact, if it sort of figures it out and finds a neutral place, then maybe that's a good thing. But then it opens up this morning down 500, and I'm sorry, I don't like that feeling of free falling. And then I came back a few minutes later, and it was up 300 points. And I don't like an 800-point bounce either. And so then it kind of got back closer to zero today, and it was up or down 70, something like that. Now, the market's about to close. Click, click, click. Open it up. Are you doing this today? Ha! Ah! Or wah! And the market is now, the Dow is up almost 2%, 1.9%. It's plus 464. So if losing 1,000 the other day made your stomach go up and down, how about a 1,000-point swing in a day? Because that's about what you've got today. And it looks like we're about to close up 464 points. I called Bob Westrick to jump back in here. And
he's still picking up your calls?
Wait. What does that mean? Because whenever I put him on, things are going bad. Is that what you're saying there, Viola?
No, what I'm saying is you're calling the poor man a lot. Called him like 3 times yesterday.
Now, are you charging me for these calls, Bob?
I am not, John.
All right. Well, you should think about it. I'll split it with you.
Turn Violetta's mic off, okay? Hey, Bob, so there was my little analysis and monologue. Jump in there. What do you want to say, sir? Now it's up 500.
Well, John, you know, you keep talking about all the pain watching the market.
Yes, it
know?
Is. And
if you don't like scary shows, don't watch them.
Yeah. Okay, but last we spoke, which was about an hour ago, you were given that spiel that I was mocking just a tiny bit there because I know, but I still don't like this. And even if I don't have money in the market, like I don't trade equities, I haven't bought a stock. I buy mutual funds, and that's part of my investment, my retirement plan. And some people are lucky enough to be in the situation I'm in, and too many are not. But I think just in general, people look at this, of course, as a bad thing, as a terrible thing. So I don't have a question for you.
John, except, you know what? Go ahead, ask a question.
No. I guess I'm calling you for some perspective once again.
Yeah, this is not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. I mean, to put it in perspective, I mean, market corrections, we didn't officially have a correction, but I mean, they're always going to happen. They're not ifs, they're whens. And a lot of times they're good because typically there's always money on the sideline, and that money's not going to come back into the market to help, you know, support future even higher stock prices unless there's corrections and dips, because a lot of people buy when it goes down.
Yeah.
Also, our markets relative to earnings have been, you know, they've been relatively frothy on a valuation basis. And so this kind of gets them closer to long-term averages. They're still higher than long-term averages. They're still, the markets are still, you know, pretty pricey. However, things like this puts them closer to the ground, closer to solid footing where they should be. So these things are things, when you invest in the market, these are things you have to expect. You shouldn't be all of a sudden shocked like you always are, John, when these things happen. These things always happen.
Yeah.
We've been talking for years. These things have always happened, and they will always continue to happen.
So what would be shocking?
Yeah. I mean, because, I'm sorry, I know that the market's correct, but I don't like it to happen in a hurry like this. I mean, if this continued, Bob, if it did, if we lost 1,000 again today instead of gained 494 at this very instant, that would be bad, right? I mean, at some point, it's a bad thing.
Well, then we would have had the correction. Quite frankly, I almost welcome a correction. It's been so long.
Yeah.
I just kind of wanted to get it off my plate.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Let's get it done so people don't have to keep talking about it. John, I've had clients talking to me for years. Oh, should we sell now because the markets are hitting all-time highs, which they have been for years and years. And all the time I'd say, well, yeah, they're high, but that doesn't mean they can't go higher. And I remember to your point, I was on your show, I think in Minnesota 2-3 years ago, and somebody I was discussing with was saying, now's the time to get out, get out, get out. And I'm like, I wouldn't do that. And that must have been, what 8,000 points ago on the
Dow? It was. That guy said, now's the time to get out, and it went up 8,000 points since.
And I remember, I kind of debated him, and I'm just like, well, you know, he may be right, but the way you accumulate wealth, once again, you want to stay in the market. Once you get like this kind of trader mentality, that's when it gets dicey and dangerous.
Market's up 509 points, 2.09%. And as Bob said, if it's a scary movie, you don't have to watch it every day. Okay, Private Vista, myprivatevista.com. One of the partners there is this guy, Bob Westrick. Nice to hear your voice again. Thanks for your wisdom, Bob.
Good talking to you, John. Take care.
What were you all excited about?
The SpaceX took off successfully from Earth. It's going to, it's heading to Mars orbit. And it had a Tesla Roadster on board. It was something to behold. If you missed it in the last 5-10 minutes, go home and watch it tonight.
Most powerful rocket ship ever or something like that. 60 zillion pounds of thrust or something like that.
Is that Elon Musk responsible for that? Is that what that is?
Yeah.
Can you believe it? It was pretty remarkable.
I think Johnny's going to have a few things to say about that before the day is over. I'm going to say.
And you don't mean Johnny Williams, right?
No, I don't even mean Johnny Williams. No. When Johnny gets here, he's late as always.
Hey, market closed up 500.
So yeah.
We got that going for us.
What did I tell you yesterday?
I don't remember.
Yeah, you said don't panic. And we didn't. We followed your guidance.
I kind of did.
There's no panicking in a situation.
I got
like
up this morning. It was down 500. I go, oh, crap.
I know. Yeah. Felt like a rocky ride.
Yeah. I mean, listen, if you like the volatility indexes, you did very well. At least one of the volatility indexes, you did well.
Yes.
And, all right. Thank you, Orion. But there is, the fundamentals are good. That's what we were talking about yesterday. This is not a time to freak out. That time is coming. There's plenty of time to freak out.
A lot of things to freak out about.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, well, don't worry. We've got plenty. If you want to freak out, we've
got
that.
Put that down on the list.
On
the list.
This is what's coming up on the program.
Show. Are you
kidding
me?
Every 15 minutes, there's something bigger to freak out about.
There is, unfortunately.
Well, one thing we haven't even paid attention to is the 8th is the day for the DACA bill and the budget, right?
I mean, the 8th of February for the budget bill.
Budget funding runs out.
5th of March is DACA. But the president said he wants a shutdown.
Yeah.
He said it'd be good for the country.
Probably won't extend the March 5th deadline on DACA.
Right. I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding when I say that. If you've not seen that news or heard that news yet today, he does say that he thinks that, you know, he's all for a shutdown. He's sort of taunting. Then his chief of staff, John Kelly, said that DACA recipients who didn't sign, people who would be otherwise eligible for DACA who didn't sign up for it, which accounts for the differential between the 700-ish thousand people that are on DACA, and the another 1 million plus who are not, that the president was going to create a pathway to citizenship for, which is part of his deal. The chief of staff is saying, listen, that other million people were either too afraid. Some people say too afraid. Other people would say too lazy to sign up for it. So look at what the president is doing. Essentially, the takeaway there is the president's helping lazy people. Look at that. So if you don't want to take this deal, shove it in your pipe and smoke it. Your frozen pipe.
It's a new saying.
Yes.
Well, listen, I'm going to get out of the way. You guys have a really good
Go
show.
Watch SpaceX. You got to see it, John.
Oh, yeah.
You'll
the rocket
it.
Blasting off
you
was pretty cool.
You got to see it.
Oh, I can't,
very cool.
On behalf of our friend Johnny Depp, I can't get behind this.